It's time once again for Dialogue Conspiracy with May Brussel. For the past 14 years, May has been researching and uncovering facts and evidence from between the lines of the news and placing them in a more thorough perspective of how conspiracy, political assassination, and abuses of power affect us all. Dialogue Conspiracy originates with KLRB-FM in Carmel, California. And now, May Brussel.
Good evening. This is May Brussel. It's Dialogue Conspiracy number 321, and it is May the 14th, 1978. Last week, I talked on Dialogue Conspiracy about the fact that I've been on the air, KLRB-FM, for 7 years, as of May the 15th, tomorrow, and with the exception of several short periods of time where I felt my life was in danger or my family's life was in danger due to various threats and subterfuge, I was doing continuous programs, but I did take several months off at two different occasions. When the overt pressure was released, we resumed these broadcasts. Now it's the 7th anniversary of this news analysis, and one more time, I guess this is for the third time, I am going off the air again. I made the decision this week to stop Dialogue Conspiracy on KLRB-FM, and I'll do one more program next week, and I'm going to talk about the alternatives. For those of you that subscribe to the tapes, you will continue to get them in the mail through the tape center. They'll be sent to you. But I'm going to do a half hour of news analysis on one side of cassette, and then I'm going to do a suggestion of problems and follow-through in order to build up an activity of more activists doing something. I don't think it's enough to just listen to the show. I think every single person could be doing something in the United States, and if they believe in any one of the things I've been talking about, and some of you believe in at least three-quarters of it, probably not all, but at least three-quarters of it. And I'm going to talk about suggestions of confronting people like Emil Younger, who's running for governor, or Ed Davis, running for governor of California, or writing to Daryl Gates, the head of the Los Angeles Police Department, who was responsible for destroying the evidence of the Robert Kennedy assassination, writing to the FBI director, Mr. Webster, about the continuous cover-up of these conspiracies and crimes. I think that those people who want to be active and take some part of directing the course of their lives should have some kind of instructions or guidance, and I don't think it's enough to just give this news out in the air and follow it through. And I feel like the Free French that were fighting Adolf Hitler in Germany, that you don't give all your plans on the air. You can send them through letters and telephone calls to friends, but you don't have to be so overt on the air and give plans of action. And I think that these suggestions should come through the mail. So as I say, this week and next week, for all purposes, I believe, will be the end of the seven-year series as it exists, known as Dialogue Conspiracy. Since last week, when I was on the program, I both made a movie and I saw a movie. The movie I filmed was the Howard Hughes Mystery. For those of you that don't remember or weren't listening, last June in 1977, and Dialogue Conspiracy, the June 26th tape, talks about it. I went down to Los Angeles to film the opening and closing and about six inserts of a movie called The Hughes Mystery. It stars Broderick Crawford, Hope Holliday, and Cameron Mitchell. And my part was to write lines that introduce the movie and then interrupt the movie, and then it closes with me. Parts of the soundtrack to that movie were taken in possession by the FBI and CIA. The producer, Manuel Zissima, had been in contact with him, and he knew that they had the soundtrack. Part of the film, he told me, was missing, and I thought the film would be shelved. But the pressure seems to be off what Manuel is doing. He's an independent producer, and he knows the people from the Hughes organization and from the CIA. And he seemed to feel that this year he could get it out again. It's been sitting there in a can, ready to be distributed. So we refilmed these scenes. I did them with McDonald McCary, the actor, and he did some of the lines with me this time. And it is supposed to go to Europe for international sales and distribution in May at the time of the Cannes Film Festival. And it will be shown all over the world in Latin America, South America, Asia, because the producer-director has his own distribution company as well. I don't know if it'll ever be shown in the United States. I hope so. Manuel offered me to have a premiere showing here in Carmel, California, and that I could give the proceeds to any charity that I saw fit for the proceeds from this movie, which was nice of him. And so that if we decide to do that, KLRB will announce it, and I will be on the show from time to time, at different capacity, hopefully working with the station or the talk show on Sunday nights, and we can talk about the movie. And this charity I would like to see it go to would be the Freedom Foundation that Douglas Wallace has in Vancouver, Washington. He's the attorney who has filed in the court of Houston, Texas, to exhume that body that is buried under the name of Howard Hughes. And he's been very active, and along with Preston Truman in Salt Lake City, who obtained for me the original Colby report of the CIA director, Clarence, Mr. Colby, William Colby, to Senator Howard Baker. I think of Clarence Kelly, the FBI man who suppressed the fingerprints. That was my correspondence, but the CIA director of during the time of Watergate was working with the Senate committee and covering up the Hughes connections to Watergate. These people in Salt Lake City and Vancouver, Washington, have been very important in giving me documentation, and I would like the proceeds, if not a local charity here in the peninsula, which I was thinking of, then to go to Doug Wallace. But there may be a charity here that is worthwhile that the money could go to, and we will have the movie here. This last week, I saw a movie besides making a movie, and it's called The Serpent's Egg. And I'm sure most of you missed it. I would have missed it. It was here for 1 week, and I was looking forward to it for 4 months and didn't notice it in the paper until the night it was, the last night it was showing. And, of course, ran down there with several friends to see it. And I'm going to talk about it because many of you, or most of you, haven't seen The Serpent's Egg. It was written by Ingmar Bergman, and I think The Serpent's Egg had a lot to do with my decision to stop Dialogue Conspiracy at this time, and that it really moved me so much. As no matter how much research I have or documentation, they say one picture is worth a thousand words, and I think The Serpent's Egg was the one that pushed me over the brink, that really upset me the most of anything that I have witnessed in the last 7 years. It's difficult from the reviews in advance to know what the movie is about. I knew it was about pre-Hitler Germany. I knew it involved a cabaret similar to the Isherwood story, I Am a Camera, that was later made into a movie and play called Cabaret. The Serpent's Egg, as described by a doctor in the last scene of the film, is a clear plastic bag. It's an embryo which nurtures the deadly serpent. And you know that out of that sack, which is visible, will emerge a thing that is going to kill anybody it can touch or reach. And you see it nurturing and growing through that sack, becoming overtly dangerous and waiting until its birth time comes and becomes the full serpent. And Bergman makes it clear at the end of the film and through the film that Germany in 1923, and the whole film is set in 1 month in 1923, that at that early date, that the world would have reason to know by watching it grow in 1923 that world control, world death was going to emerge out of Germany. Germany was going to suck in countries like Austria, Poland, Romania, Italy, Estonia, Lithuania, Yugoslavia, France, Holland, Belgium, Middle East, South Africa. They were going to suck them into their system of death. They didn't have to invade England. England had financed Adolf Hitler. They bombed some of England, but they went towards Russia. The English people and the United States government nurtured in that embryo that serpent, and it created the womb in which Nazism and fascism was introduced on planet Earth. Now, The Serpent's Egg had to do with a character. I don't remember his name or if it was even mentioned in the movie. It was played by David Carradine. So I'll just refer to him as Carradine. And the woman, Love Allman, the female in the cabaret, Carradine's sister-in-law in the play, I will just refer as Allman, Love Allman. Carradine is an American from Pennsylvania living in Germany in 1923. The movie opens and closes with film clips of people, young and old, walking through the streets. There's depression in Germany. There's no jobs. There's no food. There's inflation. Cigarettes are a million marks. Decadence, degeneracy, sexual fantasies acted out in nightclubs and cabarets, violence everywhere, clubbing and fighting and drinking, false gaiety in the beer halls, drunk, happy time. Carradine is doing a circus act in Germany in 1923, but his brother has a hurt wrist and can't do the trapeze. So he's taking time out, and the brother's wife is working at the cabaret. His hand is hurt. Carradine is an alcoholic. He drowns his everyday problems in drink. He steals from his best friends to get the drink. It doesn't matter so long as he drinks. When the movie opens, Carradine is walking into his rooming house drunk. The boarding house people are singing downstairs, and he goes upstairs and his brother is dead. That is the first violence of the movie. There's a gun by his bed. He's blown himself out through the mouth. There's blood all over the wall. In the same manner that Agent George de Morenchild killed himself, or the former president of Cuba, Carlos Prio Siqueiros, killed himself in Florida a week after de Morenchild was dead, or within that short time period, both working with the people that killed John Kennedy. The former girlfriend of the brother, he has another girlfriend, dies soon afterwards. There's a needle in her heart, and blood is coming out of her mouth. Everywhere he goes, the people around him are dying. He's taken to the mortuary, and seven people that are close to him die all within a month's period. Love Ullman, as I say, works at a cabaret. They're at the cabaret the night of the glass when Hitler's men and the police come in, smashing Germany, or similar to the night of the glass. It preceded those nights of Nazism where everything was smashed. And the man who ran the nightclub, they go up to him and take his head and just completely smash it right there. And everybody watches. And nobody raises a hand. Their faces are just still. The entire nightclub is demolished and burned, and they watch it, and nothing happens. And nobody could do anything then, and they couldn't do it today if it happened today. Any more than the people watching the house in Los Angeles, California, the SWAT team came, and the police set up their cameras and their guns, and six people were inside, and everyone knew they were alive in there. And they burned them and carried it on national television dinner time, and the neighborhood and children watched, and we could do nothing, and nobody was prosecuted. There was no trial for those SLA people who were burned down in the summer of 74, and that was it. That was the end of them. Well, Carradine gets a job for himself after the cabaret smashing. He goes to St. Anne's Hospital, and he's given a job in the archives room. And the archives room are identical to what you see in Utah, the Salt Lake City Mormon databanks of everybody of planet Earth that exists today. And there's thousands of feet of walls and nothing but files and files and miles of files. And the end of the route is a room with a table, and he's told to take material from the brown envelopes, the yellow envelopes, no questions asked. And the files were as long as the files today. If you microfilmed them and reduce them, they could be today, 1978 and 1923. But this was 1923. The movie is set in 23. And 23 is the year that Interpol was started, the international police in Vienna. It was the year when the genealogy list for Adolf Hitler and anti-communists were going to be put into form, where every Jew, Gypsy, non-Aryan would be listed. Later, it was to include these files, where it include every person, as I say, on planet Earth and their ancestors back to the year 600. The Hitler files, the SS files, got national and international acceptance in 1933 and 43, and J. Edgar Hoover, our head of the FBI, became vice president of Interpol in 1946, when the files were moved from Hitler's Germany to Brussels, and then to France. And the year 1923 is when the files were really going to be started, when Interpol was founded, and that's when this serpent's egg was fomenting. The police call in Carradine, and they show him at the morgue all these people. They've died these deaths, and he could have been charged with circumstantial evidence because of being with each person as they died, but they let him off. And then he leaves his apartment. He and Ullman, his sister-in-law, have to leave their apartment. And a close friend of theirs, a doctor, locates for her outside of St. Anne's Hospital an apartment where they can live. And she's working at a laundry nearby, no more cabaret. And he's working on the files in the streets. And one day he comes home from his job, and Ullman is also dead. And in the bed, her mouth is bleeding and blood is coming from her mouth. And he sits on the bed because she hasn't shot herself in her mouth like her brother, but they explain later they have ice picks that go through the heart, and then the blood comes out of the mouth. And as he sits to see her, to see this death, and they were close. The camera shoots him, and he hears a camera, and he knocks the wall through, and there is a camera photographing him with her. And he was seen with these other dead people. Then he jumps up and breaks another wall, and there's another camera. And he breaks another wall, and there's another camera. And they were rooms like the CIA runs today, that Tony Lasowitz, a Watergate fame, ran with the girls from Chappaquiddick. And he had them all in these walls with men that were supposed to be boyfriend and blackmailed them with their sexual expertise. And also Mary Jo Kopechne from Chappaquiddick, who died at that time, 1969, in the car of Senator Kennedy. Her roommate ran the whorehouses for Bobby Baker, and she died just prior, I forget the time sequence of the death of this roommate, Mary Jo Kopechne, but she ran whorehouses with Bobby Baker to connect the congressman with this kind of scene. Well, he breaks through another wall of the apartment, and there he is in the back of St. Anne's Hospital, which is similar to what I would imagine the Hughes Medical Institute is capable of building, or the Arley Foundation I've talked about, or those 10 medical places I've warned you about on Dialogue Conspiracy that are funding millions of dollars for experimentation. And Dr. Jose Delgado of Yale University and UCLA, Dr. West, and new article just out on electrode implants at UCLA. And I think I was the first person to publish about that in the LA Star. Well, anyway, this doctor speaks to Carradine, and this is what he says. He says, this center is for human experimentation. And he shows him movies of people and how he gets them to shoot themselves in the mouth, commit suicide. He shows rooms that they have with sensory deprivation, how they take a woman who's perfectly normal, taking care of a baby who's crying, and by not providing the needs for the baby keeps crying, and the woman is forced to murder the baby, how they turn her into a murderer. They show people going totally deranged with one substance of a chemical. And he says, the doctor says to Carradine, and transposed 23 to 1978, or continuously since 23, he said, in effect, this isn't verbatim because I didn't write down in the movie, I'm ahead of my time. These experiments and files will be used. The masses out there, and they show the same masses that the movie opened with. He said, the masses out there are too apathetic. They are weary. They can't rise up. There won't be any revolution against what we're doing. But wait for the youth to get together, he said. The six-year-olds in the picture would be 16 in 10 years when Hitler emerged in 33. The nine-year-olds would be 19. Their parents would have no jobs. There'd be inflation and stealing and violence. And then he said, we will use these files and experiments. They will be ready for us, and they are all here. Like the serpent's egg, he says, you see it coming, you can watch it grow. And the movie ends with a man laughing and talking about 1923 elections that were held in Germany. And he says how funny it was that a man named Adolf Hitler ran and lost the election. And of course, all of us know that 10 years later, Adolf Hitler won the election and that the serpent was born. Now, the thing that got to me was that he explained to Carradine through movies that every single person that Carradine knew in that movie had died not by accident or suicide, but was photographed and controlled purposely, and that their rent was provided, and that he was just one person among all these people. And the chief of police says, I will let you escape. And this is supposedly 1923, where an American didn't have to escape from Germany, but transposes, say, to 78 in America. And he says, I will let you escape. All these people that you knew were subjects of experiments. Now, I think of this country with 40% unemployment of all blacks under 25 years of age, the racism in housing, a strike in San Francisco this week of educators because of racism in the school system and the firing of blacks, the 12 blacks in Congress that were on Nixon's enemy list, Julian Bond said he's retiring, he's not going to run for office, the black people being used, a few of them used, by like Andrew Young or Sammy Davis, but most of them going under with no leaders, and racism in jobs, with medical experiments rampant in the USA, mental experiments completely out of control with government funding or support, and a crisis can take place in this country, depressions, no proof that we have our gold still in Fort Knox. They're talking about selling it now, but that's a way to cover for the losses that are being used somewhere else. And people are as inactive as they were in Germany in 1923, 24, 25, 26, 27, and on up today. Now, I could identify with what Ingmar Bergman was saying and with John Carradine, the actor, because I've talked before on Dialogue Conspiracy about my own personal life. Many times I've shared with you a lot of things. And I want to talk about what's happened to me just since February the 6th, 1978, and this is May the 14th, because I can date a press conference in February at Mark Lane had at Larry Flynt's office in Los Angeles at Century City, where he had brought FBI agent Wes Swearingen to help him with the investigation of John Kennedy and Martin Luther King's assassinations. As I said before, my son Marvin was at the press conference. He questioned these people. He was perfectly normal and terribly alert and had all of his rockers together. And then 2 weeks later, he called me that he came home into his apartment and there were writings on his typewriter and sayings of Martin Luther King and Sirhan Sirhan, and that he felt he was being set up for something. And I told him at the time, close your apartment and get out and put everything in storage and show the police those things, photocopy them, file a record that somebody possibly is setting you up and get out, which he didn't do soon enough. But eventually, 4 weeks later, he came up to Carmel and was completely almost out of his head. He's much better now. He recovers from this, whatever it is that happens to him, through some mild medication, but he was completely out of his head. I mentioned that Grant Dewey, this friend that I stayed with in New York City, came home to his apartment. Somebody had left matches inside. Grant doesn't smoke. They were strewn on the floor. He corresponds with me and takes the tapes. He closed his apartment, put everything in storage, and got out. I had lunch with Lillian Castellano, and she wanted me to stay down till the next Friday because there was a citizens committee to work to expose Ed Davis and Evelyn Younger for suppressing the Robert Kennedy assassination. I came back to Carmel on Friday. I didn't stay. The next Thursday, Lillian was found dead in her apartment. We know that she wasn't too well, and she had a weak heart, but she was doing the most important thing that could be done in this election year, and Lillian was dead. Larry Flynt was shot March the 6th, 1 month to the day about of this meeting that we had down in his offices in Los Angeles, left paralyzed and almost died. As he said last week, he had about 2% chance of living, and those people have never been apprehended. Meyer Zelig, one of my very close friends and associates, one of the foremost experts on Alger Hiss, died of a fatal heart attack within that time period right after Flynt was shot and Lillian died. He has a new book that was ready to be published at the hands of agents. He's a close friend of Alger Hiss. But Meyer, he wrote Friendship and Fratricide. That was one book he did on the Alger Hiss-Whitaker Chambers relationship because he's a psychoanalyst. But he never got his book published. A man named Alan Weinstein has his book published with national coverage that Alger Hiss is wrong, that he was a communist, and that he was guilty. But the counterpart of that cannot be alive to talk about his book, which is completed on continuous work of the most extensive files in the United States of America on Alger Hiss that belonged to Meyer Zelig. He was sitting in the living room with his wife, Winnie, a friend of mine he killed over, and he was dead. Larry Flynt took over The Realist, a magazine that Paul Krasner started, a counterculture paper, and said, I'll get it out for you, in Columbus, Ohio, and began to get a mailing list, and they were to publish, and I gave them one article for the first issue of The Realist because I wanted to test if Larry Flynt was for real and what was happening and if Paul Krasner was a puppet and for a front man for them or what was going on. Paul said, write for The Realist, and I wrote one article called Who is Afraid of the Torbit Document that I've spoken about many times on KLRB, and the whole discussion in print of how the Kennedy assassination came about. What happened? The article will never be published. The Realist was closed. All five people that worked for Krasner were fired. He was up here in Carmel this week with me. Paul Krasner's down to about 120 pounds. He's frail. He is a puppet on a string. He's wasted. In fact, he said he has a fantasy that someday maybe he'll just come back to Carmel and be a disc jockey at KLRB and give up Century City and Hustler magazine and the trap that he got into. And he suggested there were things he would tell me someday, which I know are coming down there, and he couldn't tell him. So The Realist was shuttled in that article, the test article I did. He wanted me to do one on Son of Sam, you remember. I wanted to see just who is calling the shots here. The shots were that The Realist was closed and Larry Flynt was shot. And then
you notice the Hustler is still going on, the multi-million dollar Hustler, but a little rag sheet, you know, 20 or 30 pages with a few pieces of information for a handful of people in the United States, maybe a mailing list of 1,000 or 2,000, that's closed down in this same time period. Then Larry Flint brought the L.A. Free Press, and it was a place where Mark Lane and Dick Gregory could get their research out. I don't agree with everything they do, and I don't happen to like those two men, but it was still a place or a conduit to get some documents out on the assassinations and what's coming down in America. After Larry Flint was shot, the Free Press completely folded. And as a Berkeley Barb said, they survived the anti-war years, they survived the LAPD and Evelyn Younger and Ed Davis and everything else, and it took the Flint operation and a paralyzed Flint to close down the LA Free Press, one of the few sources left of the alternative press in the United States. And my son Marvin writes songs. He was working with a manager by the, well, I won't give his name on the air. He's a well-known music producer and manager, managed the top song last year for the arrangers who did Car Wash. And Marvin was at his house, and Emmett Grogan was there, the man who founded Diggers in San Francisco at the Haight-Ashbury section, at the scene, and they were helping the kids with food and housing during the 60s. And Emmett Grogan knew Marvin knew about him because of my research and my stories of how Diggers was taken over by the intelligence community, and violence and death and drugging and insanity was imported to ruin another good thing. Well, within a month or so after Flint was shot, Emma Grogan was found dead on the subway in New York at the end of the line at a beach in Long Island, allegedly with a syringe or something. Nobody had a firm explanation. The newspapers didn't have much. They had a wake of his up in San Francisco. But how many wakes can you have? 1,000 wakes? 2,000 wakes? How many deaths are taking place and the people bury them and then go back and do the same things? And I feel that I can't do any more. If I give out information on KLRB and tell you, and if you can't use it in some way, then there's no point in even talking about it. If we don't have some kind of an active organization where people invest money just in getting their own tapes and listening and having meetings and deciding some kind of political action like the GI coffee houses during the war, then there's no point in just talking like a peep show, a view of the CIA for 30 minutes every week, and then close shop. And then finally, in my own home, I've gone totally bananas for 1 year because there's a person taking out my daughter, Barbara, who I have suspected of being a plant from Texas since last year. And I live in fear. There's constant turmoil there, and I can't do on the air what I have to do, because last time I went off the air was because of Barbara, or once because of the Manson family, Sandra Good, and once because of Barbara, because her name was used surreptitiously to come down to a police department late at night, and she wasn't there, and it was a trap being set for me. But they knew her name, and they knew where she was, and the children's name are on my FBI files, and it's very clear that I've been under surveillance. The documents are available, and they will come out in that trial against the Rolling Stones in September in San Francisco. I'm working with the attorneys, and part of the trial is going to be the extensive surveillance and damage that has been done to me and my family since 1966. Now, I'm not bowing out, and I'm not going to be less active. I'm going to be more active. But I can't do it in the form I'm doing it. This person has been with Barbara for a year. His brother's on the Dallas Police Department. He worked for Clement Stone for 5 years before he came to Carmel, and Clement Stone is raising $2 billion as part of the Korean CIA and American CIA movement to turn the world Christian. He has no noticeable income tax record for the last 4 or 5 years. He's provided with housing and car from Pebble Beach. He supports himself by residuals of selling cancer insurance to the Pacific Grove, Seaside, Monterey, and Marina police departments. I can't live with that kind of pressure, and I have to meet it head on, and I can't talk about it on the air all the time. Anybody who knows me knows what's going on. This person has no telephone. He has no noticeable ID, no P.O. box in town, no office to sell the insurance from. He gets loans of $4,000 with no collateral from Wells Fargo Bank. Somebody comes in and signs it. And I have to live with that kind of a zombie telling her mother, telling me through Barbara that her mother is a witch, her mother is crazy, while he sweeps her away and verbally and literally has entrapped a situation that scares me. And I have to be more active. I have to go off the air. I don't want to, but I think it's the right time to do it. So next week on Dialogue Conspiracy will be my last 30 minutes, and I will give you some constructive information. You can get lists of the last shows that I've done since March of 77. You can listen to them. You can hear the information. You can order the books. And then I will next week spend 30 minutes on constructive suggestions for what you're going to do. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about what I'm going to do. And I'm going to thank KLRB for the time that I've had with you. And thank you for sharing the time with me, your psychological support, your research support. And I love all of you, but I do have to change the route, and we'll start it next week.